248 years ago, this nation was conceived in liberty by a document that is still quoted today around the world. Come join the listeners of this station to gather in front of the Udall Park Rec Center at 8:30 a.m. July 4th for a 9 o'clock public reading of the Declaration of Independence. That's 8:30 a.m. Thursday, July 4th, in front of the Udall Park Rec Center, 7200 East Tankaverde Road.
This is my chief worry as a conservative, that we have put so much power in the office of the presidency that someday the wrong man could come along. And I wouldn't be so concerned about whether he could use these powers to perpetuate himself in office, but how he would use these powers to destroy people that disagreed with him.
I am very willing to let the American public judge my physical and mental fitness. So today, I applaud Canada.
Government is not our master, it is our servant. Its only power, that which we the people allow it to have.
Liberty Watch is an independent program on KVOI dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master, and operating in the public interest for which the media in this country was designed, by exploring controversy. This helps us to resolve our differences peaceably, refining controversy into clarity through investigation, research, interview of experts, and public feedback. Liberty Watch is based in objective reason and is biased towards individual liberty, and so is not the view of the station or anyone but the host, guests, and callers. Liberty Watch operates outside the realm of political correctness, taking no notice at all of race, creed, religion, ethnicity, political affiliation, or orientation, focusing on content of character in eternal vigilance to the free flow of information about government, technology, current events, and our steadfast Constitution. The program is paid, produced, hosted, and operated by Charles Heller, and any mistakes are solely his responsibility. Ah, responsibility, the topic keeps coming up. Debbie Werthnow is the president of iVoter Guide, a vice president of American Family Association Action, and a member of its board. Debbie holds a master's degree in computer science from Princeton University and worked as a systems engineer at AT&T Laboratories for 5 years. She spent many years as a stay-at-home mom while organizing events for her church and community, and she joined iVoter Guide in 2011 as a data analyst and was named president in 2018. Under her leadership, iVoter Guide evaluated 13,000 candidates and educated 6.8 million voters in 2022. She's also the organization's spokeswoman, and you're going to find out why when I pot up her phone line, and has appeared on a whole bunch of stuff. So, without further ado, welcome Debbie Werthnow to the microphones and telephones for the first time of Liberty Watch. Hi.
Well, it's an honor to be here. It's nice to meet you, Charles.
You're ditto, and I'm glad you see it that way. That's the whole idea. So, let me ask you on foundation about the iVoter Guide. Who started it, and how long has it been around?
Well, it was not me who started it. Mm-hmm. I say iVoter Guide is a tapestry woven by God. Mm. It was created by two individuals, one of whom was a very grassroots activist. He ran the Family Policy Council in Texas for decades, mm-hmm. and had this light bulb moment of, I know a lot of these legislators, but I've never voted an intelligent ballot from the top to the bottom, and started researching candidates, looking at who they gave money to, who gave money to them, how have they voted, who's endorsed them, sent every candidate a survey. And he did that in Dallas County back in 2006, mm-hmm. and filled a 4-inch binder with paper. In a parallel thread in this tapestry was a guy who's a retired
IBM
programmer.
Debbie, slow down. What? What did you say after he filled the book with
four? He filled a 4-inch binder with information on all of these candidates. And he then actually gathered friends around a coffee table, gave them each a copy of the binder, mm-hmm. and they scored every candidate. Hmm. Then they printed it and passed it out in churches.
Huh.
So that was where the concept of looking iVoter Guide is, the concept is what do candidates do, not just what they say. Ah. Because actions speak louder than words. So, but that was very time intensive and it was very paper driven. There was another individual from Austin, Texas, who had the, he was a retired programmer for IBM, had written actually Bible study software, and God gave him the concept to do a voter guide, but on the internet, he just didn't know how to do a voter guide. And so God brought those two individuals together. Jim was the programmer, Richard had the concept, and they started creating iVoter Guide. And they did it just in Texas in 2008 and 2010 in the 5 to 7 largest counties, but top of the ticket all the way down to Justice of the Peace and Sheriff and all of those races. But it was after 2010 when they said, you know what, Texas is doing okay, but the rest of the nation needs help on candidates. So they went nationwide in the 2012 election, and that's when I came on board. So I came on because I knew Jim, the programmer's wife, was my Bible study teaching director. And when I asked God what to do with my empty nest, I asked Cheryl to be a job reference. And she said, you have a background in computer science, and my husband programs this online voter guide that's been complaining that he needs some help. Would you like to help him? And I had prayed for God to give me an open door or an open window, what he wanted me to do. So in I came. Just helping Jim with the website, and I bubbled up to be president by 2018.
He gave you an open cliff to jump into something on the bottom.
He threw me into the deep end, is what he did, Charles, because I wasn't that activist. I wasn't the grassroots person. I had friends I would call to say, who do I vote for? But I was not that friend.
Got it.
So I really represent the audience of iVoter Guide.
Let's go into some of the details of it, okay? I pulled up iVoter Guide for my address, for my own residential address, and it only showed Republican candidates. How does one look at the other party candidates on your site?
On our site, we're a ministry, and we're a Christian donor-supported ministry, so for bandwidth reasons, we research the candidates that are more closely aligned with what we feel are biblical principles. So we cover the Republican primary elections. When it comes time for the general election, we will have every candidate on there. So we're not covering the Democratic primary, but in November, you will find not only the D's and the R's, but the Libertarians and the Greens and every candidate that's on that ballot.
Not to mention the Zoroastrians. I noticed that the ratings for conservatism were the same. Now, this is getting into the weeds, and if you don't know, it's okay to not know, all right? I'm not trying to, I don't bring anybody on here to run them up on the rocks. I'm asking questions for clarity only. I noticed that the ratings for conservatism, they have like a gas gauge between kind of pinkish and then all the way to deep red, were the same for both Mark Lamb and Kathleen Wynne, who are both running. Hang on one second. Caller, hold on. I'll be with you in a minute. Are both running for Senate in the Republican primary. And I noticed that their conservative ratings are about the same, which doesn't seem to line up with what I know about them. I know both of them personally. How do you determine their ratings politically? What's the metric for that?
We use publicly available data. So we start by if they've ever held office. We've gathered their scorecards, which Mark Lamb does have because he was a legislator.
No, he's the sheriff of Pinal County.
Okay. I'm looking at the little green check mark that shows that he had a scorecard. So he was scored by Gun Owners of America. We consider that a scorecard.
Okay.
If you click on the View Candidate Profile, you will see the data that we've gathered on every candidate. So we start with scorecards. If there's any organization that has looked at a legislator or an elected office holder and scored them on their issues, we try to get as many scorecards as we can find that are out there. But because not everybody's held office before, we also look at who they've given money to. So we've gathered selected contributions to and from each candidate. We have both the Federal Election Commission's database of donations for federal candidates, as well as Arizona and any state where we cover state candidates. We've got their entire campaign finance database, and we're looking for ideological indicators of their values or their positions or their policies. We also gather endorsements from whoever has endorsed the candidates. So we can see that Mark Lamb has been endorsed by the Arizona Republican Assembly and by Patriot Parents. We give every candidate a chance to answer our survey questionnaire, which those candidates did not do, but we also do independent research. And then we have an army of volunteer panelists that we vet and we train in what to look for in candidates, and they do a, use the internet to read their website, to read their Facebook page, to read their social media accounts, to read their websites, if they're able to go to some candidate forums to do some digging and gather information on those candidates. So, you know, we gather everything we can find that's publicly available, and then all of those individuals give us input into what we use for that rating. So it's every data point we can find, and you can see the data points on the website.
Huh. That's a really complete answer, more than most people actually give on this program. I deeply appreciate the details. I think they're both a little bit more red than you have them indicated.
Well, I will tell you, let me explain the ratings just a little bit then.
Okay.
So the ratings go from verified liberal to verified conservative, and so it's not just on are they a very conservative person. It's more on is there proof, is there evidence of actions. And we really keep that bar pretty high. So the verified conservative is not a common rating because we really want proof in the pudding. We actually have added a far right and a far left rating, which you'll see probably in the November election when there are some Marxist open borders, or if you look at our presidential voter guide, one of the presidential candidates receives a far left rating. So that's why the gas gauge has ranges, and sometimes you'll even see a conservative conditional rating where everything we found looks like they're conservative, but we just don't have enough data to have confidence that it's a solid conservative. Then we have the leans conservative, moderate, and leans liberal that are kind of in the middle of the range.
I wish we wouldn't use liberal. I wish, because liberal is actually a compliment. Liberality is what liberal, Thomas Jefferson was a constitutional liberal. And liberality simply means open-mindedness. A true liberal is someone who's open to suasion, and people on the left are absolutely not. They're very closed-minded. And some people on the right are pretty closed-minded, too. But the thing is, we ought to call them leftists and or centrists or conservatives, but I think liberal is actually too complimentary a term. We can discuss it on the other side of the break with Debbie Werthnow of the iVoter Guide. Back after this.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening to Liberty Watch with Charles Heller, Tucson, Arizona.
This is Herman Cain. You'd get some good bargains on the Swap Shop on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice, and have Charles make fun of your stuff.
Yes, I'm down on my luck. I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Never mind the lawyers, guns, and money. Just send software engineers, right?
Amen.
The voice you're listening to is Debbie Werthnow. She's the president of iVoterGuide.com.
Yes, sir. iVoterGuide.com.
Okay. And tell us just real briefly, you know, 20 seconds, what is the American Family Association Action Group? What are you?
We are the legislative and lobbying arm of American Family Association. We are the C4 side, and iVoterGuide is one of the three divisions of AFA Action, and our goal is just to equip people to vote wisely. It's not an endorsement list. It's not a list of who to vote for, as you noticed, with two Senate candidates that have the same rating. Mm-hmm. We're really just trying to give good information to voters so that they can choose which candidates are more worthy of their vote, because we feel like too many people don't vote, or they don't vote a full ballot. And so iVoterGuide is covering, you know, hundreds of candidates across, or thousands across the nation, and hundreds in Arizona this year.
Can I give you a really brief example to fortify what you just said?
Sure.
Kimberly Yee, who is the state treasurer in Arizona, got thousands more votes than did Carrie Lake in the governor's in the recent governor election. Talk about an undervote. A lot of people undervoted Carrie Lake.
That's surprising. What we in our studies, we've seen that a lot of people, it's as many as one in three, 35-40% of people will leave at least one race blank on their ballot. And if it's a nonpartisan race, like a school board race or city council race, it's half of people. So it shows me there's a lack of information on candidates, and iVoter Guide is really there to try to go as far down ballot as we can. There will be even some school races, school board races we're covering in the November election this year, because information is power, and we the people need the information to be good stewards of our vote.
What's the chance? I'm asking you to be a little introspective. If you want, take a breath and a second and answer this. What's the chance that it might be a little bit of confirmation bias on your part, and that what really happened was people had deep questions about the candidate and were hesitant to vote for that person?
I think that could have been the case. And in your Carrie Lake example, it could very well be the case. The cases we looked at were school board and city council, where I personally think that it's just they don't know who to vote for, and they don't want to vote for the wrong person. There's a lot of information out there about Carrie Lake and the Senate candidates and the presidential candidates. But when you get down to local races, what do you know about those people?
Right, nothing. You win the Liberty Watch Award for intellectual honesty.
Thank you.
How about that? There's no,
I'll take it.
There's no running you up on the rocks, because there ain't no rocks for you to run up on. That's pretty transparent.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
My pleasure. Rarely do I say stuff like that to somebody during an interview. At the end, I may offer something, but usually not during the interview. iVoter Guide researches what the candidate, you mentioned this earlier, has done, including scorecards, campaign finance, as well as endorsements. You said that as well. And issue surveys. Are candidates, generally speaking, reticent to fill out your surveys, or do you get a pretty good response?
It varies, and it depends on the state. We've encountered some states where we get as much as 50% of candidates who answer the survey, especially in the party primary. But there are some states where even the GOP establishment political consultants will tell candidates, don't answer it, don't go on the record, which is why we look at so many other data points. And I will tell you, I mean, as a voter, I always wanted to see what a candidate would say on their survey, but that's just what they say. And sometimes they do different things. So that's why we look at every data point when we're assigning those ratings of candidates.
Let me take a scientific, wild, assumptive guess here that Maryland is one of the states you almost never get a response from. Am I right or wrong?
You're right.
No, as a guess. That was an intuitive guess. I don't know.
But it is true. It is true. Surprisingly, Kansas is another one, because they have people, they're the consultants who will tell candidates to not want. So sometimes I'm surprised. Sometimes I'm, you know, I expect it. But, you know, we even had one candidate who, the candidates get to preview all their data before it's released and even see their rating. And one of the candidates didn't like the rating and had answered our survey. He said, didn't I tell you everything you wanted to hear?
Red flag.
Exactly. What you had done. So we really try to get as many looking at votes and actions as the best teller of how we assign those ratings to candidates.
I'll be darned. I learned something from this. All right. What resources are you mentioned it a little bit, but what should, to drill down just a little bit in the last 4 minutes here, what resources are available on iVoterGuide.com to better educate voters?
Well, everybody nationwide can go to iVoterGuide.com. We are covering all 50 states, federal races in all 50 states, and statewide and state legislative races in over three dozen states. So go to iVoterGuide.com, and as Charles did, you enter your address, because we want to make voting as easy as possible. So you enter your voting address, and we use that to show you just the races and just the candidates that are on your ballot. So you don't have to know I'm in State House District 13. So we'll show you the ones that are on your ballot. You'll see the little gas gauge. You'll also see the words view candidate profile, and you'll see little green X's that are either checked or not checked, and that shows you what data points we have on every candidate. So you can, you know, use the gas gauge as a guide, but, you know, sometimes they're both rated conservative. You can look at the candidate profile, and on that profile, we'll give you every piece of publicly available information we can find, links to other scorecards, links to their website, links to their social media accounts. Go read about them. Go look for them yourself. Our goal is to make voting easy. And we also have resources on our Take Action page. If you want to tell other people about iVoterGuide, I would encourage you to sign up for our email list, because we will not flood your inbox. We don't share it with anybody else. We'll just let you know when we release a voter guide that's upcoming in your area. And we just said once a week an educational piece of information about, you know, what does the Attorney General do? Or, mm-hmm. you know, what does the Bible say about different issues? Because we want people educated not just at ballot time, but on the issues.
Some states have got disclosure laws that require you to report who your donors are down to the second and sometimes third level. Arizona just passed an egregious one in the last voting cycle. Does that affect the way you report at all?
Because we are a C4 organization, we do not have to report our donors. We are donor supported. But so I don't think that that applies to us as a C4 organization. But I think I'm going to look into it.
I think you're going to look into it when we get off the air and work on Sunday a little bit. Because Arizona just passed a voter initiative that requires you to report not only your donors, but your donors' donors. It is really egregious. It's something that
Be on the ballot or it passed?
No, it already passed on the ballot.
Oh, it was, gosh. Okay, I'll look at it.
You need to look at that, because I have a funny feeling I smell a Goldwater or a Goldwater or a Heritage Action lawsuit coming in the wind. There's a lot of people are going to sue over that, a lot. But because
they may be one of them.
It doesn't just, what do you mean maybe? It doesn't just walk on the First Amendment. It runs it through the ringer. Let's see. Does iVoter Guide cover ballot issues as well as candidates?
We do. We don't cover absolutely all of them, but we cover ones relating to life, ones relating to election integrity, religious liberty, the key tenets of values that are important to us, and there's a ton of them that are going to be on the ballot this year. So we have a whole special team that looks at that and says, not just here's what the ballot says, but here's what it means. Here's who gives money to support it. Here's who gives money against it, who's endorsed it both ways. Same, not telling you who to vote for, but it's gathering all that information into one place so that you can really understand it. There's been a lot of disinformation out there on previous ballot measures. We're trying to combat that.
Arizona has got an abortion measure on the ballot that legalizes abortions to the last 10 seconds of pregnancy.
There's like several other states in the same case in November. So, yes.
Yeah, I know.
We are working on making sure the truth gets out there.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I'm not going to get that. We don't. Abortion's one of the issues I don't get into on this program. I just don't. But it's an important issue, and it's on the ballot, and it's important to have information on. Okay. One last time, because we're out of time. How do people get more information on iVoterGuide?
Go to iVoterGuide.com, enter your address to get your ballot, sign up for our email list. We'll keep you informed. Share it with your friends and your family, because everybody needs to be a good steward of their vote, and that's why we exist.
Debbie, you've been a joy. I really appreciate your time on the air with us, okay?
Thanks, Charles. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. You have a great day. And that clears the deck for the next year. Who's calling right now? We'll be with you in just a little bit off the air. Stand by, Buck. And let's see, and we get this portion of today's program brought to you in part by Tucson Coin and Autograph. Tucson Coin and Autograph does exactly what it says in its name, and they have some wonderful memorabilia you can get, and they also have some phenomenal things like this round that I have, this ounce of silver with the fella throwing the tea off the bow of a ship in Boston Harbor in 1773. If you'd like one of these, they're available for the spot price of silver plus $6, which is very fair. And they're at 6350 North Oracle, and they are on TucsonCoinAndAutograph.com. And if you want on the phone, 219-4427. That's 219-4427. And we'll be back in just a little bit with Buck Doherty on the other side of this break. If you want to get in on the conversation, talking about some of the most recent and fascinating and mostly very good stuff out of the Supremes.
Thank you for listening to Liberty Watch.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop.
Bunker is so funny. Is he married?
Bunker, call back.
It's Bunker, and I'm single, and I'm looking for a rich widow with a large ranch.
I've never even been on online dating. I believe in meeting people the old-fashioned way, alcohol and bad judgment.
She sounds like your type, Bunker. Swap Shop. Sundays 10 to 11 a.m. right before Liberty Watch.
It's a matter of jurisdiction, the power to speak the law. It's jurisdiction that matters after all. Back in the trial court, you have an opportunity to be heard. It's the adversarial system on display and in the flesh. Hoping to a just result, the court will rise.
And talking with us about that just result is returning. Excuse me a second. Clear my throat. And is Buck Doherty, his litigator, his senior litigator with the Liberty Justice Center. And he's been on recently, so I won't go through the entire bio, but I will tell you that there's some very, very important cases that are on the table here. And one of them is Missouri versus Murphy. And briefly tell us about the parameters of the case and then what the court did on it.
Yeah, well, it's great to be back on your show, Charles. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
So, the Supreme Court came down with their decision in Murphy versus Missouri a few days ago. This was obviously a very important case. About this time last year, I believe it was 4th of July, when Judge Dowdy in the Western District of Louisiana issued a preliminary injunction enjoining several officials, including Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General, from communicating with social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, because they were coercing these private social media companies into censoring speech, which if the private platforms just did that on their own, based on their own content moderation policies, that would be fine. There would be no violation of the First Amendment. However, the lower courts ruled that there was this coercion that was going on, and the Fifth Circuit affirmed this broad injunction that prevented the government officials from communicating with the platforms. However, the Supreme Court reversed a few days ago and said that the plaintiffs, and there were several plaintiffs, including the states of Missouri and Louisiana, along with several individual plaintiffs, they said that they had not shown that they had proper standing, meaning under the Constitution, there must be a case or controversy that actually exists before someone can bring a lawsuit in federal court. And the Supreme Court determined that those plaintiffs had not shown that standing. So they didn't really go to the merits of the First Amendment claim, which is unfortunate because we didn't get to really learn much of anything about how the Supreme Court was going to treat, you know, coercive actions. And there was extensive evidence that, of course, it's been out in the public domain for quite a while. But we don't kind of know what the court's view is on what the parameters are with government officials communicating with social media platforms and basically having the platforms act as proxy to censor material and information and speech that the government officials don't particularly care for. So that was essentially the case. It was a huge First Amendment free speech case. Really didn't get to the merits of the First Amendment and kind of kicked it out on standing and remanded that back to the lower court.
Buck, why did they ignore the Twitter files?
That's a good question. It's a great question because the Twitter files did have quite a bit of information. Of course, after Elon Musk purchased Twitter, these series of Twitter files that were released, internal communication back and forth that were released to various reporters that got reported a year or so ago, we learned a lot. We learned that there had been high-level communication between government officials during COVID-19. And I should have mentioned that the Murphy case also dealt with communication during the 2020 election as well. But there was a lot of information where these government officials, high-ranking officials in the White House, were very upset that Facebook, for example, was not censoring speech that these officials thought, you know, went against their policies, basically, in terms of COVID-19, vaccination, masking, and those type things. So that's a great question. But really, they didn't go to the merits. They kind of kicked it out and said, well, the plaintiffs had you know, asked for an injunction for future relief, and but really had only kind of had examples of past conduct, and it wasn't really clear what the court, you know, could do in terms of an injunction. And so they kicked it out on that. Of course, there was a strong dissent by Justice Alito.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 6-3 decision, and actually Justice Barrett was the authored the majority opinion. Justice Alito went into a reason why that he felt that the plaintiffs had met the standard threshold and that the injunction should have been upheld. But of course, it's a dissenting opinion, so that was kind of how it was left. And
yeah.
So that case still goes on, but the injunction is wiped out, and you know, we'll see how that case plays out.
Buck, how many more bites at the apple will it take to get the First Amendment amendment reinstalled into at least Supreme Court jurisprudence?
Yeah, great question.
That's
we actually
two in a row.
The social media and you know, we basically had the internet for 30 years, basically one generation. So, you know, that's the $64,000 question. How is the First Amendment going to be applied to social media and this kind of new technology called the internet that everyone uses every day? And we don't really have kind of those answers yet.
Can I lovingly interrupt you for a moment?
Sure.
It's not about whether it's social media or anything else. It's the principles of the First Amendment, just like it's the principles of the Second Amendment. The anti-freedom, the true gun nuts, the anti-freedom people, wail. Well, the Founding Fathers didn't have the AR-15 to deal with, so we can't pay attention to principle. And it's the same damn blanking thing with the First Amendment. What case is it going to take to shove that up them to get them to acknowledge the First Amendment?
No, you're absolutely right. And the principles of the First Amendment, when it was written, I mean, people have argued, oh, well, it didn't mean flag burning or whatever. Well, yes, it did, because it meant that the principles of speech apply to new forms of technology. And so it shouldn't be a problem, but it seems to have been a problem in the social media context. I agree with you that there are a lot of First Amendment problems, and we see that all the time. We have a lot of different cases that we bring that are not First Amendment social media type cases, where this is exactly what you just said is going on throughout the country in many forms, whether it's public school with a student or with a teacher or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
That is a problem. But this was really important, obviously, because of social media, the way social media has become so big in Americans' lives.
It's become the de facto media, a news source for many, for a good portion of the population.
Exactly. So in that sense, I think it was important. And I agree with you. The principles of the First Amendment should be applied regardless of what media or technological advance we have at our disposal. And those principles are alive and should always apply. So, yeah, I agree with you on that point. But this issue with the social media, this case was heavily watched. There were a number of amicus briefs that were filed. And it would have been nice if we could have had a ruling on the merits, but the court didn't want to go there. They got standing.
Let's focus down on this. What is needed to gain standing?
Sure. So basically standing, you need three elements. There has to be an injury, a concrete injury. There has to be traceability, meaning however you're injured, whoever you're suing, somehow they had to have play a role in.
There has to be evidence.
Right, causation. But it's not a strict high-level causation standard that you've got to show to ultimately prevail. And then the last one was kind of the one that the redressability. What can a court do? Okay, you've been injured, and we know that Mr. Jones over here or the federal government has injured you. What's a court supposed to do? And an injunction stops them from coercing the social media platforms is essentially what the relief that they were seeking. You know, stop government officials from coercing social media platforms to censor Americans' free speech. And they wouldn't have normally done that. And that's a reasonable position, an argument. Justice Barrett, in the majority opinion, said that the redressability, they really hadn't shown that they could tie that in the future, really, that there was going to be continuous injury to them. Just because there was past injury, there wasn't going to be continuous injury. And in dissent, Justice Alito said, well, it seems like the court is implementing a new standard on redressability that we've never had. Whereas it seems like the court is saying a plaintiff has got to be certain that a defendant or a government official is going to.
Yeah. I mean, somebody is holding a heavy weight above you. There is no proof that if they let go of it, that it'll drop and injure you. We need proof of that.
Right. And that level of proof is not supposed to be there just on standing. I mean, yes, the Constitution talks about a case in controversy. We don't have courts just to resolve philosophical disputes or debates.
No, there has to be an articulable damage, right?
Correct. But it's never been this high is what Justice Alito is essentially saying in his dissent on redressability. You're now basically saying you got to win your case at the standing threshold, which is not what standing is supposed to be.
No, it sure isn't. The only thing that has standing here, though, is the commercials. Stand by in just a little bit, and we'll be back with Buck Doherty of the Liberty Justice Center about the Missouri versus Murthy case.
This is Dennis Weaver, and you're listening to Liberty Watch. You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country. And Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom.
When lawyers' litigation goes without examination, you can bet that it won't take very long. With rules and regulations and without representation, pretty soon you'll sing a slavery song. No, go ahead and go your own merry way. But I can tell you that you'll soon curse the day. You were asleep at the wheel, you didn't know what was real, you'll learn the hard way.
Well, the purpose of Liberty Watch is that people not learn the hard way, but the informational way, and to that end we have with us Buck Doherty of the Liberty Justice Center, and Liberty Justice had an amicus brief on the case of Missouri versus Murthy, which is a First Amendment case about whether or not the federal government could interfere in social media companies with what they throttled for information. It was considered disinformation in quotes, and how they throttled that. And basically, the decision gave the government a green light to do exactly that, to impinge on at least the idea of the First Amendment, if not the letter of it. Two questions, and then I want to move on to Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. Question one is, briefly, why do you think that Amy Coney Barrett, in writing for the majority, ducked this issue?
I don't know. If I knew that, Charles, I would be dangerous. I listen to the full oral argument, and Justice Barrett, it struck me at the time that she was unusually vocal. I mean, they've got a procedure now that kind of came out of COVID where each justice asks a question and they kind of go through those rounds of questioning. She seemed to be just extremely vocal, more so than I had ever heard her before, and she didn't seem to be particularly happy with some of the responses. So I think, you know, and maybe we're getting a little glimpse of some of the issues that that are important to her, which is kind of the standing and civil procedure and kind of the process of federal litigation, and not so much, you know, to the merits on the First Amendment. We don't really know kind of where she's going to come out on that. So I don't know. Perhaps I think one of the criticism, you know, even from people who are sympathetic to this case, is that the injunction itself was so broad that it was unworkable. And I think, you know, the injunction basically said federal officials can't communicate at all. You know, I mean, the point being, you're not supposed to coerce a private social media company to do your work, to do your bidding, to censor Americans. You couldn't do that as a federal official. So you certainly shouldn't be able to do it, you know, have a private media, social media company do it. So I think the injunction was problematic. Some people criticized it because it was too broad and it should have been more narrow as to as to, instead of having a blanket sweeping statement that no federal officials can, you know, communicate with social media platforms, I think that was problematic. And maybe this was a way to, you know, deal with that, just say the plaintiffs don't have standing. And so you see that frequently. Obviously, you have to meet the case in controversy to have standing, but you do see that sometimes on a difficult question that where some areas could be gray, that a court might go the standing route and say that the individual doesn't have standing.
Briefly, and I mean that because we're going to run out of time. We only have 8 minutes left. Briefly explain the doctrine of standing, if you would, so that the audience has a more holistic view of what the purpose of the doctrine of standing is.
Yeah, so it came out of a case called Lujan, and as I mentioned earlier, kind of alluded to it, some people may disagree that, you know, the Supreme Court, federal courts don't exist just to kind of have these philosophical debates. There must be an injury. Someone must be injured. So, for example, in the First Amendment context of Murphy, there would be a chilling of speech. You know, that's considered an injury. You know, you violated someone's First Amendment, you chilled their speech. So that's clearly a concrete injury, and that was fine under the Murphy analysis. And there must be a traceability. Whoever you're suing, that individual or individuals, they must have had, there must be some kind of link or some type of causation that would show that they would be the parties that you would sue to try to, mm-hmm. You know, correct your injury. Mm-hmm. And then the final component was the redressability, meaning that the courts, whatever relief you're asking, and basically we're talking about two reliefs, money damages or injunctive relief. Money damages typically compensates a party for a past wrong. And injunctive relief is kind of this future relief where you're saying, okay, court, we want an injunction stopping the government official from coercing social media platforms who then, you know, violate my First Amendment and censor my speech. And the court, the majority, felt that the redressability prong, this future injunctive relief, it wasn't a clear direct link.
Right.
Yeah, and it just wasn't doable, right?
Right.
And that's essentially the doctrine of standing.
Okay. Great. And the reason for it being that if you don't have standing in the court, then anybody can sue anybody for anything, and you turn into chaos, right? Is that?
Yeah, and federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. I mean, basically, you can get into federal court two ways. If there is a federal question, and obviously the First Amendment is a federal question, federal constitution,
mm-hmm.
or if there is what's called diversity of citizenship. So even if you don't have a federal question, let's say you have a breach of contract and you've got the parties from diverse citizens, like, you know, I'm from Tennessee and I'm suing Charles, who's from Arizona. We're diverse, mm-hmm. and the amount in controversy is over $75,000. So those that will get you into federal court.
Mm.
So there has to be, again, they're limited jurisdictional type courts, and there must be a case in controversy, which is in the Constitution. There must be, you know, we want our adversarial judicial process to have competing sides, and therefore the theory is that better laws will be developed when there's more at stake and you have two parties opposing each other, fighting it out, and kind of the steel, iron sharpens iron kind mm-hmm. of analogy that, so yeah, that's essentially what that means.
So in other words, it's encouraging you to have a vehicle worth more than $75,000 so I won't damage it across state lines.
Yeah, there you go.
Ergo the doctrine
people
of
do that. Yeah.
Ergo the doctrine of attorneys driving Mercedes. All right, I digress. let's go on to Loper Bright Enterprises Inc. versus Raimondo. Briefly, what was that case about?
So yeah, you hear a lot about the deep state and the administrative state. Well, this was really about the deep state and the administrative state, because it overturned what's called the Chevron doctrine. It came out of the case in 1984, the Chevron case, which basically said that administrative agencies, you know, under the executive branch, Congress passes a law basically, and they say, we're going to let, you know, OSHA or the Department of Labor, you know, enforce this law. And we're not going to put all the rules in right now. We're going to let them figure out the rules. Well,
that has a consequence. Yeah.
Correct. Exactly. So Chevron basically said, well, we're not going to let the courts interpret ambiguous rules or laws or whatever Congress, you know.
Yeah, well, let the agencies do it.
Right. We're just going to defer, to the agencies, which is in the executive branch. And a lot of people have criticized that because that violates the separation of power, that Congress passes the laws and the executive branch enforces it. But the way it had been kind of carried out in a number of agencies over several decades is you kind of got, you know, prosecutor, judge, and jury. You've got these executive branch agencies doing everything, and the courts are deferring to the agencies. And so Chevron said even a court should just defer to whatever the agency because they're the experts.
That's right out of FDR. That's straight out of the socialist platform, running a society based by experts.
Well, you're exactly right. And it's been criticized. And, you know, finally, Loper Bright, you know, the question was put before the court, should Chevron be overruled? And they said yes. I mean, it was a huge win because, you know, it's returning interpreting laws that Congress passes to judiciary, to judges, which is the way it should be.
Right. That way you've got an injunctive relief available if the agency oversteps its authority. Is there any significance to the fact that Roberts wrote this, or was that just the rotation of the way the decisions are written?
Well, as the Chief Justice, he can, depending on their initial vote, he can assign whoever he wants to. So he obviously, anytime you're going to overturn an important decision like Chevron.
Oh, that's why the Chief Justice did it.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's I wasn't in the room, Charles, but I'm guessing that was the thinking behind it, because everyone knew it would be a big deal to overturn Chevron.
I just learned something. Thank you. We're down to the last minute, actually 50 seconds. Did you write Liberty Justice Center's amicus brief in that case?
In Loper Bright, I did not. One of my colleagues did. I worked on the Murphy amicus brief. One of my colleagues worked on the and wrote that brief in Loper Bright.
Who was the client that you wrote the brief for, if you're at liberty to say it?
You know, I think we did that maybe on behalf of Liberty Justice Center. Do a number of amicus briefs, and I would guess it would be on our website. So certainly libertyjusticecenter.org.
It's fine. I'm not grilling you. One last, how do we, 15 seconds, how do we get more information?
Yeah, libertyjusticecenter.org. And I would just have one plug. We do have a case that's similar to Murphy, Justin Hart versus Meta Platforms, and several government officials, including Vivek Murthy. We anticipate we'll be filing a cert petition at the end of July, and we look forward to that.
All right. We're over the hour, so I have to let you go. But God bless you for what you do for freedom, Buck Doherty.
Thank you, Charles.
My pleasure. Have a blessed day. Well, clears the deck for the next guest. And AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. Stand by for America Armed and Free.